Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und Ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
702.
The Naked Scientist.
Naked Scientist is here at 17 minutes to 3 o'clock. Dr. Chris Smith, we're going to jump straight into it as the questions are already flooding in. One says, my toddler grinds their teeth in his sleep. What causes teeth grinding and is there a cure for it? That's from Dave in Mogale City.
Oh, hi, Dave. Well, bruxism is the medical term for tooth grinding. And it's actually very common. And some people do it because they're anxious. Some people just do it habitually. It can be damaging to the back teeth because you can wear them down. If this is happening and it's a new thing and it keeps on happening, keep an eye on it and then seek advice. If it's been going on for a long time, nothing's changed, I would certainly seek advice from a dentist and possibly also a medic. But at this stage, talk to a dentist because there are various things that can be done to make sure that all is well, it's not doing harm, or if it is doing harm, how you minimise that harm. But it is very common, and I'm aware of a number of people for whom this is an issue, and they know they do it because their partner says they grind their teeth at night.
So is the suggestion, doctor, that if it is common, should they maybe look at taking their toddler to a child psychologist?
No, I wouldn't at this stage, because the thing is, one always asks, when someone presents with a problem, you always ask, well, how long has this been going on for? If they say, well, it just happened yesterday, then you're much less concerned than if they show a pattern. This has gone on and on and on for a long period of time, because things can stop as soon as they start. So if it's a new thing, it's just happened once or twice, it's much less concerning than if there's a pattern of behaviour there. So the first thing to do is to look at the pattern of behaviour. How long has this been going on for? When did it start? Can you identify anything that might be linked to it starting? These are the sorts of questions that will be asked. If it is a new thing, it's much less of a concern than if it has an established track record, in which case it's worth also seeking the counsel of a dentist, because they can have a look and make sure there's nothing else going on or anything that can be missed. And then they can make some practical suggestions about next steps.
All right, we go to the lines. Thank you so much, Dave, for that question. All the best with your toddler. There's a question here that says, how is a person with a pacemaker declared dead? Because I've heard of an incident where someone was dead, but their heart was still pumping, which also begs the question, what does it mean to be dead if your heart beats, but you're dead? This is from Ruahile in Johannesburg.
Well, first of all, what's a pacemaker? A pacemaker is something we implant. It's an artificial device that's put at the top of the chest, and wires are threaded through blood vessels to go into the chambers of the heart, and they deliver an electrical pulse that captures the muscle cells in the heart and triggers them to begin to discharge, and the wave of discharge spreads through the rest of the heart and creates a normal heartbeat. And we do this in people where there is a problem with either their own heart's pacemaker, because there's a special population of cells in one part of the heart, it's called the sinoatrial node, and if you have a problem with that, or the conducting system, there's a pathway of wires within the heart that carry an impulse from your heart's own pacemaker down to the correct point to initiate a heartbeat in the heart. If there's anything wrong with that system, then either the ventricles can beat out of sync, they can beat inappropriately, or they beat too slowly, and this can translate into performance problems for the person. They have heart failure, for example. So we put a pacemaker in to regulate the heartbeat and make sure that the person's got adequate output to go about their daily needs. Now, when a person dies, the heart stops beating, and we wouldn't declare someone dead if they still have a beating heart. Unless, and there are circumstances where we would still declare someone dead with a beating heart, and that is where they are judged to be brain dead, because there are certain circumstances where if a person has a catastrophic injury to their nervous system, for instance, drowning, or they had some kind of chemical injury or carbon monoxide poisoning, and they were neurologically dead, but they were rescued and their heart was restarted or never stopped, that person has no prospect of survival potentially, but they may still have a heartbeat. And under those circumstances, we may still declare someone dead, as in brain dead, and a decision might be made to switch off life support, whatever's helping them to keep breathing, for example, under those traumatic circumstances, an awful situation, but it does happen. The person still has their systems and organs functioning, but their brain isn't. And under certain circumstances, those people also donate, or the families kindly agree that a person could donate organs. And so we sometimes have beating heart donors who have had a head injury or have got brain death, massive stroke, for example, but their organs are all in excellent condition. And so under those circumstances, because that person has no prospect of life, they can donate their organs and then they're allowed to pass away. So we generally, if we're called to say, has this person died? The doctor will go and they will make a thorough examination of that person, and they will look for a period of time for signs of life, respiratory effort, and they will also feel for any evidence of heartbeat. And if they find any of those things, they certainly would not sign a death certificate until they had explored much more thoroughly as to what the circumstances were.
And I'm glad you explained it that way, doctor, because that must be the most difficult scenario for doctors to have to deliver news to a family, because in that scenario, I mean, countries are different. It still requires the family to make a decision of sorts.
I think it's very, very difficult when you're faced with a loved one and they are alive in front of you, but they are at the end of their life because a machine is keeping them alive. And the one saving grace in this circumstance is that a doctor and the healthcare team can explain to a family what the situation is, and the family have an opportunity to spend some time with their loved one. You don't end up in a circumstance where you say, right, well, it's the end of the road for this person, we're just going to switch everything off. This is done with enormous care, consideration, forethought, and in discussion and agreement with the family. And so nothing is done as a knee-jerk thing, and people have the chance to come to terms with that, to think about how it is, say goodbye to the person concerned. So it's done very sensitively, very carefully, and only with full agreement of everyone concerned.
Can I ask a question just quickly, doctor? So when doctors turn off machines, and they usually will say that the family can be in the room and things like that, what happens in the scenario where the person just keeps breathing on their own?
The normal outcome with this circumstance is that when machines are turned off, people slowly just slip away, and it can take seconds to minutes, and then a person goes into a respiratory arrest, and then shortly after their heart will stop. And that is the common way this happens. But sometimes there's enough residual activity in the parts of the nervous system that coordinate things like breathing and heart rate that people don't necessarily slip away. And under those circumstances, you would give best care. You provide supportive care to that person until you reach a decision as to what to do next. But I luckily have never been in that position.
Okay, thank you so, so much for that question. Let's try it again. Cynthia in Johannesburg, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my question, and I'm not strictly sure if this is in the scientific field. I'm just wondering how words actually understand, form. I can understand words like water, which makes a sort of whooshy sound, but what about words like brick or stone or tree or grass? Have you any idea, and as I said, I don't think this is really in your realm, but how words have developed.
So how have words developed?
Well, we do have quite good ideas as to what the brain does with language, because we can put people in brain scanners and you can give them tasks to do. And brain scanners work by comparing levels of activity in the brain when you are and aren't doing things. And you can therefore say, well, if we present someone with a task and a certain region of the brain becomes relatively more active, it's probably involved in that task. And when we ask people to listen to words, a particular region, the angular gyrus, and a region on the left-hand side of 90% of the population's brain lights up. And this seems to be where words are stored and decoded. It's the so-called receptive speech area. If you ask people to make up a sentence and articulate it, a different region of the brain, which is forward of that other region. It's called the expressive or Broca's area, lights up. And this region seems to be concerned with making words come out. Then you can say, if someone has brain damage and it damages one or the other of those areas, how does it manifest clinically? And a person who has damage to the receptive speech area can't understand instructions that you give them. They just don't understand words. It's like someone speaking a foreign language to them. On the other hand, if they damage the region of the brain in the expressive speech area, they can understand everything you say to them perfectly, but they can't articulate the words when they want to speak back to you. They know what they want to say. It's quite obvious that they know what they want to say because you can see the frustration in them. But the words come out as word salad or gobbledygook. So the brain clearly divides language into two different things, making sentences and saying them, and understanding sentences and words. How does it actually do that? Well, if you think about what speech is, it's sounds. And so the auditory pathway, sounds come into your ears and sound waves are converted into a pattern of brain waves, which are then presented onto this region of the brain that decodes sounds. And speech-related components receive messages about those sounds and the words that are being said. And the pattern of sounds are used to activate populations of nerve cells that respond exclusively to certain words. So in the same way as when I see certain things, certain populations of nerve cells light up in my brain so I know I'm seeing a face or a dog or a car. When certain words are uttered, a population of nerve cells is recruited, so you know that that particular word is coming in from your ears. And then other bits of the brain whose job it is to understand and apply details about the context and linking different constructions together, they begin to decode or deconstruct the sounds further and work out what the meaning is. And that's then shared with the rest of the brain consciously. So if you learn a language and then you learn another language, that bit of the brain that's doing that decoding actually gets bigger. And people have shown that you have more cortex, more grey matter corresponding to decoding and encoding speech because of learning additional words and additional language.
Thank you so much for that question. Let's go to John from Santon. The main question that John wanted to ask is around how does one determine how long a person has been dead for? So if you're told they've been dead for 4 hours or a day, how is that calculated?
Well, pathologists and particularly people who are interested where it really matters when someone died from a forensic point of view, they have models they can use, as in a graph almost, where you can take the temperature of a person, and we know what normal body temperature is, and based on what they're wearing and the surroundings, you can work out roughly how fast they should lose heat. So one way to do this is one looks at the temperature, and for recent deaths, this is quite accurate. Once a person's been dead for a long period of time, much less so. Then we can look at other things. Rigor mortis is also used as one example. This is where, when we are alive, the muscles are relaxed because they provide energy to the muscle fibers to make sure that they stay in a relaxed state. When muscles begin to run out of energy, they can't unlatch the elements that normally contract the muscle, and so they become rigid and stiff. And this comes on after a fairly regular amount of time in an average person. So if a person is in that state, you know that they died more than a certain period of time ago, but less than another period, because after a while that rigidity goes away again. So you can use that as another measure. And what normally happens is forensics will use a range of different measures and see where they all intersect to try to come up with a window. You can never give it to, it was this number of hours, this number of minutes, and this number of seconds. That's just Hollywood, and that's just made up. But you can come up with a window.
You've ruined CSI, exactly. And CSI Miami and CSI Vegas for me.
You come up with a window of time where you think this is in all likelihood when this person passed away. And then longer term, there is actually, I've got a colleague I speak to occasionally in the States, and she works at body farms. There are people who donate their bodies after they die to be put out in the environment so scientists can study how long a body takes to rot away, effectively, and how the microbes that grow on that body change with time. And you can use the levels of microorganisms on and around the body as a guide to how long it's been there.
Thank you so much for that interesting question. We're going to have to leave it there till we're back together with Dr. Chris Smith.